From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a new lens on a labor movement icon as Michigan cities reconsider streets and monuments dedicated to Cesar Chavez.
This person who we now know caused a lot of pain to people and did terrible things also led a movement that allowed my parents to be in a union and have those protections.
Also, a science mystery on the Great Lakes. One ship captain's discovery of a slick, oily substance yields new biological discoveries.
It was like, hey, we got this cup of goo that came from the ship. Does anybody want to do anything with it?
And a photojournalist recreates his family's experience of the war in Ukraine.
It's really difficult to get people to pay attention to just about anything these days. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine is well into its fifth year already.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, one photojournalist talks about breaking through our collective familiarity to show the truths of the war in Ukraine.
I want them to feel it to an extent. When I view it, I feel like they might just get a flavor or a small taste. And that, to me, I think is enough.
That's coming up later in our show today. But first, last week, a years-long investigation by the New York Times published that Cesar Chavez, co-founder of one of the first agricultural workers' unions in the United States and one of the most influential figures in Mexican-American history, has been accused of abusing young women and girls, including United Farm Workers co-founder Dolores Huerta. In response, both the UFW and the Cesar Chavez Foundation have canceled or withdrawn from events honoring the late leader. That includes celebrations in Lansing, a city home to generations of migrant workers in Michigan. For Lansing City Council member Deyanira Nevarez Martinez, the news hits close to home. Her father and grandfather spent their lives picking crops and advocating for better wages and working conditions for workers like themselves. Today, Deyanira joins us to talk about how she's navigating her role in the farm workers movement with this really difficult moment. Deyanira Martinez, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, April.
The day that the story came out, you released a statement on social media that was just so loaded with thought and thoughts and emotions. It reflects a lot of grief and a lot of anger and disappointment. Do you mind sharing a little bit of what was on your mind when you wrote that?
Yes, you know, I grew up, as you mentioned, you know, my parents, both of them and all four of my grandparents were farm workers. And I was born in a migrant camp at the Arturo Ochoa Migrant Facility in Gilroy, California, which is the garlic capital of the world. And so for the first 12 years of my life, I lived 6 months in San Luis, Arizona, and 6 months in Gilroy, California, because my parents and grandparents followed the crops. San Luis, Arizona is the birthplace of Cesar Chavez. He also died there when I was 7 years old, about a block away from my house at my friend Jared's aunt's house.
They were, wow.
And so I remember I was about seven when he passed away. And my hometown is very small. It's about 20,000 people. And everyone in the community does farm work. And so I remember the grief when he passed away physically. And it really, this week really has reminded me of that grief. I feel like he's dying again. It's a lot of pain because we have to balance at the same time that this person who we now know caused a lot of pain to people and did terrible things also led a movement that allowed my parents, who both started working in agriculture when they were about 12 years old, to have water breaks and to have bathroom breaks and to have these really basic things. And so trying to hold those two things at once is really difficult.
Those are some really important human rights issues. Would you say there was a role that Cesar Chavez played in your family's access to opportunities?
Oh, absolutely. Because my parents were able to be in a union and have those protections and learn lots of things through that process of being involved in that union, is the only reason why I could be born in a migrant camp, attend nothing but public schools, and now be a PhD and a professor at a Research One institution. That is the only reason. My sister is also a PhD in neuroscience. She got her PhD at the University of Michigan. The only reason that we could have these things is because our parents and our grandparents were involved in this movement and learned a lot from it. And we were able to access things that they never were able to access. You know, my grandfather was born in Sinaloa, Mexico, came here with nothing, started working in farm work. He didn't even know how to write when he got here. My grandmother had to teach him. She was the smart one in her little town, so she got to go to third grade. And now he has two dissertations that are dedicated to him.
According to the Times investigation, Dolores Huerta, who we might say was the second in command in the movement, in advocacy and the work that Chavez led, she said that she stayed silent out of the abuse, out of shame and fear of tarnishing the image of this man who kind of became the face of a Latino civil rights movement in the U.S. I think a lot of women, I see that a lot of women do stay silent because they don't want to be seen as upsetting something that has had a positive impact, a movement, because, you know, they wouldn't want to tarnish it because of individual situations. Do you think there are conversations that we should be having, not just among women and girls, but also with men in our communities?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I am the mother of two boys. I have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old. And this is something that, you know, when we, because they've also been taught to revere Cesar Chavez, you know, this was a really important conversation to have with them because, unfortunately, you know, pretty soon after Dolores came forward with this, you started to hear right away the, oh, well, you know, why did she wait so long? And the, you know, kind of throwing it back. And it's like, well, she waited this long because of your exact reaction you're having right now. If, you know, because of this, but also because as women, and I think, you know, being part of this movement to this day, we've all heard, oh, well, you know, but if you say that, then maybe, you know, it's going to be, they're going to be able to use it against us. Or, and so all of these things that we have to kind of carry, because we don't want to hurt the movement. And so the hierarchy within, you know, social justice movements, within our Latinx community, all of these things really play into some of the ways in which we as a community enable these things to continue to happen. And I think we all need to grapple with that. And I feel so much pain for Dolores having to wait 60 years to talk about this, you know, having to birth children in that situation, and then also have to not be with those children. Reading it, I was unfortunately not surprised. I didn't know anything about it, but I also read in there so many things that felt familiar that just I myself, I think, have to do a lot of reflection.
When you say you weren't surprised, do you mean because of how people in power sometimes take advantage of silence?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And because not only do people in power take advantage of their position, but also because people in power surround themselves with enablers and then also know how to target victims who they know are vulnerable and are in a situation where they can't talk about things.
If you're comfortable, I was curious about some of the things that you might have said to your boys about all this. Would you be okay sharing what you said to them?
Yeah. So, you know, last Friday, my 10-year-old, I was driving him to a pool party in a town called Charlotte. That's not too far from here. And so it was a little bit of a drive. And I was listening to the radio and something came up about this. And he was like, wait, what happened? Why are they saying that about Cesar Chavez? Because obviously, you know, we talk about this at home. We tell him about how his grandparents and great-grandparents were all farm workers, part of this movement. We're very proud of that. And so my husband and I had to tell him what had happened, that there was this article written by the New York Times after a long investigation into these issues, and that information had come out that he had done things to hurt women, including Dolores Huerta, and young girls who are now in their 60s, but at the time were very, very young, about his age. He's 10 and not much older than him. And he, you know, he doesn't understand all of it, but he definitely understands that hurting others is not okay. And that even if it's someone that we really admire, or someone that we, you know, it could be someone in your family, someone in your neighborhood, that it's not okay and that we need to hold them accountable.
Some cities and towns and states have been reexamining, you know, how they have lionized Cesar Chavez in the form of streets or monuments named after him. And I wonder if this is something that you've thought about as an elected official, and how you might feel if that conversation gets any momentum in Lansing.
Yeah, getting to the place here in Lansing to having a Cesar Chavez Avenue was years in the making. It was the first time that a decision had been made to name a street after Cesar Chavez. It was actually rescinded by referendum. There was a whole movement to try and not to get it to happen. And so it was rescinded. And then years later, there was still efforts from the community until it finally happened. And so my colleagues and I, you know, we currently have four Chicanos serving on the Lansing City Council. Half of our city council is Chicano. And so we really want to make sure that we continue to honor that struggle, to the struggle for farm worker rights, but then also the struggle that our community, our Latinx community, Chicano community here in Lansing went through to actually get that to happen. And so as we're going through this process, the city process to get a name change, is that we want to talk to the community. We know that the community doesn't want to go back to Grand River, which is what it was before. But potentially we can look at other things that could still honor the farm worker movement, because Cesar was not the movement. He was the symbol of the movement.
Deyanira Nevarez Martinez represents Ward 2 on Lansing City Council. She's also an assistant professor in urban and regional planning in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at Michigan State. Deyanira Martinez, thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts on this.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a short break now. After that, Fact Squad looks into Governor Gretchen Whitmer's final year in office. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. When Michigan's next governor takes office, they'll have a lot on their plate. One issue at the top of the list: improving Michigan's education system. Our state has seen its literacy rankings slide in recent years. Michigan Public's political director Zoe Clark recently spoke with some reporters at Bridge about what the state has tried and what the next governor might be able to do. Here's the latest edition of Fact Squad.
This election year, we're turning to you to answer your questions about election 2026. As part of our FAQ, that's FAQ Squad series, our friends at Bridge Michigan heard from many Michiganders, particularly concerned about education and Michigan's poor reading scores. Bridge Michigan's Simon Schuster and Isabel Lohman are here. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
So Justin from Berkeley asked, quote, how can we turn around this trend? Isabel, first, what is going on with reading scores right now in Michigan?
Yes. So on state tests, less than 40% of third graders are proficient at reading. That's a new low. And then on national tests, we rank 44th for fourth grade reading. So there's a lot of room for improvement.
What has the state tried to do to improve things in the past?
Yes, so the state has given money for literacy coaches to help other teachers teach reading. They've given money for teacher training. And then, of course, there was that third grade reading law that's been controversial since the get-go. But the idea was give readers a ton of support, but if they're still really behind at the third grade, hold them back. Of course, that got held back because of COVID test scores, and then we used a lot of exemptions, so a lot of third graders ended up moving to the fourth grade.
Simon, Governor Whitmer has said that improving literacy is her number one focus during this, her final year in office. But the candidates running for her job for governor are also talking a lot about literacy. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, so as part of our Bridge Listen series, we got responses from all nine major gubernatorial campaigns about what they plan to do to address these low childhood literacy scores. And they, by and large, have mirrored what we've heard from lawmakers and the governor. They want to surge resources into classrooms, bring in literacy coaches, for example. Democrat Jocelyn Benson, she said that she wants to bring data to bear to sort of closely track every student's progress, part of a, quote, MI Kids success plan. And independent candidate and former Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan wants to guarantee every school has a functioning library in Michigan. Curriculum is the other component of this. We've had five Republican candidates, John James, Perry Johnson, Mike Cox, Ralph Raban, and Tom Leonard. They all said the state should focus on teaching phonics. But there's also a 2024 law that's been enacted that will require districts to ensure teachers have been trained in the science of reading by the 2027-28 school year. Cox also suggested Michigan should follow a model that's been used in another state, Mississippi, where they've had a number of different interventions that have led to rising literacy rates. And two of these Republican candidates also said the state should restore a requirement that would hold back third grade readers if they struggle to read at grade level. Democrats repealed that law in 2023. Now, we'll be sharing full responses to these and also five other education policy topics on our website today at bridgemi.com.
And Isabel, what do experts say to all of this?
So there's a lot of common themes in there. So the research is mixed on retention long term for students. But one of the thoughts is, what can you do to a student if they are held back again? Are there extra resources for them? Is there extra tutoring for them? Small group tutoring, that sort of thing. That's part of this. And then some people say this is the state's already on the way to doing this. The state's already giving grant funding for new curriculum. It's giving grant funding for teachers who want to take a time intensive training. But people want to see this move faster than it's currently moving.
Isabel Lohman, Simon Schuster, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have questions you want answered as part of our Fact Squad series this election, let us know. Email us at politics@michiganpublic.org.
After a boat captain notices a strange black goo on his ship's rudder, he scoops some of it into a cup. Eventually, the goo ends up in a university lab. And here, a mystery begins. Interlochen Public Radio's Points North host, Dan Wanshura, has the whole story for us today. Let's take a listen.
This story starts with a ship captain and a strange noise.
We were down in Lake Erie, and we noticed a problem.
Raul Lee is that ship captain, and that strange noise came from his propeller.
It would spin down, and it would come to an abrupt...
So Raul docked his boat, the research vessel Blue Heron, and got to work on the propeller at the back of the ship. And while he was back there, he saw something dripping down the rudder nearby.
I noticed a little black drip of stuff. We've had this boat out of the water time and time and time again in the 25 years that I've worked at the boat. And I've never seen anything drip out of the rudder post. So I wiped it off. I moved on.
The next day, there was more dripping. So Raul dropped the rudder out of its housing in the boat, and it was completely covered with this black goo.
It wasn't particularly watery. It was, you know, kind of ketchup-y consistency, black. It looked oily. It looked nasty.
There shouldn't have been anything in there, let alone black goo. Raul had never put grease or lubricant in this part of the boat before. But maybe a previous owner had? He wanted to figure out if it was oil-based, something that could pollute the water.
So I took out a propane torch and put some of it on a rock and hit it with the torch to see if it would burn. It
didn't burn. It didn't leave a sheen on water in a bucket. Raul still had no clue what it was, but he really didn't have time to test it anymore. The propeller had been fixed, and he needed to get this ship back in the water ASAP. So he decided to clean the goo off the rudder just to be safe. But before wiping it away, Raul did one last thing. He scraped a little bit of the black goo into a coffee cup and sealed it in a Ziploc baggie.
I put it in the refrigerator on the boat and wrote the little name on it. Ship goo. You know, that's the first thing out of my came out of my pen.
ship goo. A couple months later, the sample got dropped off at a lab at the University of Minnesota Duluth. What happened next? A couple of surprise scientists, an unexpected life form from the deep, and an unlikely mascot for the power of curiosity. Producer Ellie Katz takes it from here.
Dr. Cody Sheik studies teeny tiny things, all sorts of little organisms that make up most life on Earth.
I saw a meme, and it was contrary to popular belief, microbiologists are still normal-sized biologists. And so it made me really giggle.
Cody is a microbiologist at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and Rawl's boat is a research vessel for the university. Cody was just running a lab meeting when the coffee cup in a Ziploc baggie was delivered.
And it was like, hey, we got this cup of goo that came from the ship. Does anybody want to do anything with it? And so I kind of like looked at it, shook it. I may have poked at it with like a pencil or something. And, you know, it smells sort of metallic-y. It's black. It's like tar looking. And so I was like, oh, it's probably just old grease that just kind of like started to ooze out. And so I was kind of like, well, you know, we'll see what we can do. This might be kind of fun. I don't think anything's going to come out of it.
They'll do some due diligence, he figured. Do a test for some DNA and see if there are any microorganisms in there. So he handed it off to his grad student, Abby Smason. Like, hey, can you just run a DNA kit on this and see what happens?
I do these DNA extractions all the time. And so I was like, okay, it's just one more.
It's hours and hours of pretty mindless, repetitive work.
It's a lot of moving things just back and forth between tubes. I usually turn on like a few albums and I listen to it. Charlie XCX or like Blade, like some hyper pop type thing where you just kind of drown it out in the background.
She scooped the goo into a test tube and mixed it together with a bunch of different chemicals.
It kind of reminds me of like when you had an easy bake oven and it's like a little recipe.
Later on that week, they were like, oh yeah, I got DNA out of this.
It turned out the goo was full of life. There was DNA, a lot of DNA.
I was like, okay. That was like very surprising.
It wasn't just tar or grease like you'd thought, but some strange substance crawling with microorganisms.
Ship goo just in general, like the black oozy part. It's like just multiple organisms all living in this matrix of this gooey stuff.
Cody was intrigued, so he decided to spend a little more time and money figuring out what exactly was in the ship goo. He copy-pasted the goo's DNA sequences into this huge global database of DNA, and a few of the organisms looked a little familiar.
And so I was like, oh, that's fun, oh.
But then the computer started spitting out question marks for pretty basic categories. Like, it should have been able to say, this bacteria belongs in this broad group, or that archaea, which is basically another type of single-celled organism, falls into that classification. But the computer couldn't do that.
And I was like, oh, well, that's a little bit more interesting.
It wasn't that ship goo just contained a few new species. It seemed like it contained big categories of organisms, previously unknown to science. And as he identified more, he named them. Ship goo 001, ship goo 002, ship goo 003. But Cody's a microbiologist. This was a little surprising and a little cool, but it's not unusual for microbiologists to find totally new organisms.
It was probably more like a woo, not like a woo kind of moment.
What was new was where they'd found these organisms. In the most mundane place ever, a ship's rudder. Cody says a lot of sexy microbiology is about going to exotic places.
A lot of us get real excited about going to extreme environments. Oh, if I go to this glacier, nobody's been on this glacier. Nobody's been at this depth in the ocean. And those are really fun questions to answer. Like, what does life look like in this extreme environment? And so sometimes it's just like you overlook some of these other ecosystems.
Ecosystems that are equally extreme, just less sexy. Like a ship's rudder, where there's limited oxygen, but life is somehow surviving. Cody realized that maybe all ships have their own mini ecosystems, their own gut microbiomes, kind of like we do. Cody's grad student, Abby Smason, also thought this was pretty interesting.
I was really excited. I had just started doing this, and it didn't seem like very glamorous work to me. Like, we're looking at, like, microbes.
And yet here they were on the edge of something pretty cool. New types of life in a totally unexpected place. Still, though, it was pretty niche.
I was like, oh, like, the science people are going to love this. Like, people who are really interested in microbes are going to love this.
And then last summer, the University of Minnesota Duluth media office shared a press release.
We've had press releases go out before. And, you know, maybe one or two articles get picked up and it's like, okay, that's fine.
This next story is about a newly discovered life form found on a boat.
A mysterious life form was discovered after a research vessel docked at the port of Cleveland.
Turns out that this black goo is actually a life form.
Coming up, a mysterious black goo was found on a ship docked in Cleveland, and Alien and X-Files fans see the writing on the wall.
People loved ship goo.
The extent of it is insane, and I think it's definitely my 15 minutes of fame.
People made a Wikipedia page, social media accounts. There were comparisons to a gooey black alien life form in Marvel comics that survives by finding a human host called Venom.
We are Venom.
And to The Blob, a 1958 sci-fi movie starring Steve McQueen.
Very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater.
The goo itself had become a weird, lovable mascot for scientific curiosity.
Turns out if you have a catchy name and it looks kind of fun, people are like, oh, this is science I can get behind, right?
This is all kind of entertaining to Cody, because this project was an accident. But he loves it. He uses extra research money to keep paying for it. He works on a paper when he can, hoping it might get published in a scientific journal someday.
In my day-to-day, and every professor's day-to-day, like, we're so inundated with everything else. Managing students, thinking about budgets, thinking about the next grant that we have to write so that we can fund the students, so we can think about more budgets. Our minds are, like, about to explode a lot of times.
But ship goo is pure fun. It's exploration for exploration's sake. What he's trying to figure out now is how all these organisms in ship goo work together. How do they live and thrive in this ecosystem for so long? Could they be useful?
We're like going little bit by bit. We're taking one puzzle piece at a time and saying, okay, we're examining this puzzle piece and we're putting it in, right? And we're staying interested because, like, we're building this bigger puzzle, right? And, like, putting everything together, this bigger picture.
It all sounds a little abstract, but there are other seemingly obscure microbial discoveries that later turned out to be life-changing. Like the famous case of Thermus aquaticus. In the 1960s, researchers found Thermus aquaticus, a bacterium living in hot springs at Yellowstone National Park, which was fascinating because scientists thought it was too hot for living organisms. For years, that was that. But in the 1980s, genetics was taking off, and scientists needed a faster way to copy DNA. They needed an enzyme that could withstand heat. And then someone thought, huh, I wonder if that hot springs bacteria would work. And it did. The enzymes from Thermus aquaticus are still used in that DNA copying process today. It's a process that makes it easier to identify genetic disorders and test for infections like COVID and HIV.
What we do in science is like we publish and we put out these ideas and then people can go and test them or use those ideas to build upon their own.
Someone discovered Thermus aquaticus and then someone else built on it. And I don't want to oversell ship goo. Maybe someone will discover something super important, like whether the microorganisms in ship goo corrode metal. Engineers might like to know that. It's also possible that will never happen. But that's just the risk of doing science, asking questions that lead to more questions. Abby Smason, Cody's grad student, is at the beginning of her scientific career. She moved to Duluth from Texas to study certain bacteria that could lead to more algal blooms in Lake Superior. And this whole ship goo experience, it's reaffirmed the work she's chosen to do.
Even my current project is more of an exploratory project. It's not like hypothesis driven. It's not saying like, we think this will happen if we do this. It's just like, well, what's out there?
And she feels like fewer people these days understand why asking that question, what's out there, is still worth the time and money.
It's a lot of little pieces. And so even if you don't understand the little piece of why something is being researched, it could help with a bigger picture.
And that is what ship goo is. A reminder to keep asking questions and keep being curious.
That episode was produced by Ellie Katz. It was edited by Morgan Springer. Additional editing by Peter Payette, Claire Keenan-Kurgan, and me, Dan Wanshura. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. And special thanks to Doug Ricketts.
It's time for a quick break now. When we get back, a filmmaker brings audience members into the reality of life in Ukraine through an immersive virtual reality.
For me, this is a way to try to get audiences to concentrate beyond scrolling past photographs or videos on TikTok. They have to sit here and kind of experience this for a full 10 minutes.
It's a conversation with filmmaker Joseph Sywenki when we return. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend, the Ann Arbor Film Festival is screening a unique work that combines virtual reality technology with documentary storytelling. I got to try it out this week. Take a listen. This is just a taste of what I experienced while I was wearing the maker's goggles and headset.
It looks like the anti-missile defense has caught at least some. Oh, and then there was a hit on the building directly across from us.
Oh, you know, you do get a sense of the blasts.
And it's 2 a.m. in the world of this documentary experience. I can almost smell the smoke.
This 10-minute immersive VR experience is called Is the War Close? And it places you as the audience in a home in Kyiv, Ukraine, during Russian drone attacks. Using gaming technology and spatial audio, this creation allows you to move around the scene freely, as if you were really there. It's based on real-life events and directed by Ukrainian-American photojournalist Joseph Sywenki. Joseph is a documentary and breaking news visual journalist. He's lived in Ukraine for the past 20 years and covered Russia's full-scale invasion for the Wall Street Journal. He's currently a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Michigan. Joseph Sywenki, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Before we sat down, I had a chance to go through the experience, and it just brought up so much. But could you maybe start by telling us a little bit more about your background reporting on the war from Ukraine?
Sure. I started working in Ukraine almost 2 decades ago. I covered the entirety of the Euromaidan Revolution from 2013 into 2014, and then the initial invasion of Ukraine starting in Crimea and the Donbas at that time. I concentrated many years on photographing severely wounded soldiers and activists. And then I actually happened to be in the United States when Russia launched the full-scale invasion in 2022, but my wife and kids were back home in Ukraine.
Words fail.
Yeah, it was a tough time. They got out fairly quickly after the initial full-scale invasion. And then we went back, my wife and I, after a few months, and I got to work doing what I do as a photographer.
Yeah. You were there when no one was sure if this was going to be just another attack. You were there as we saw that Russia's commitment was perhaps for a long haul. At what point did you start to feel like something beyond 2D photos, maybe even something beyond a 3D treatment or a film treatment, might bring home for people what was happening?
I actually started experimenting with 360 video and 6 degree of freedom virtual reality back in 2017. And it's an incredible technology, but it felt, the people I was working with are fantastic, but they're gamers. And we did a VR experience that was very gamified. And I remember kept thinking, wonderful, wonderful experience. But I remember thinking that we have to do this in a much more simplified manner.
Also, there's something about even just using the word gamified for the experience of an air raid.
Yeah, there's no gamification in this experience.
This is happening right now.
This is happening every single day, every single night. It's happening during the day as well, but primarily at night. But how I came to working on this experience and creating it is I was here in Ann Arbor with my kids last year when I was a Knight Wallace Fellow and Wiser Center for Europe and Eurasia Distinguished Fellow. And my wife is back in Ukraine. And I'm following along on the air raid alerts and messages coming in on my phone and what's happening in back home in Ukraine.
Which are detailed.
Very detailed. And I know exactly what that feels like, what that sounds like. And I texted my wife, like, basically just tell me you're safe, that you're away from the windows, you know, follow the rule of two walls, at least be in the bathroom kind of a thing or in the hallway. And she said, yes, I'm here. And that's when I realized there's got to be, this is the project that I'll be working on for the next year. I just knew instantly that this is what virtual reality is really good at.
For those who've never tried a VR experience before, can you describe the experience people will have if they come to the showing of this experience?
Sure. First, they'll hear a voiceover of a young girl. It's based on my daughter. And she asks her father, is the war close? And that's something my daughter actually asked me at one point. It was, again, literally the middle of the night, and I was carrying her from her bed to a hallway where I'd set up a kind of a mattress on the floor. This is where we bring our kids when there's a larger attack. So we don't always go into the shelter because it'd be just too much to
constant
do this every night.
Yeah.
So we take kind of a other precautions. And I was moving them a little bit later than I should have because I try to let them stay in bed as much as possible. And there was a large blast. The room lit up from the explosion in the sky. And she asked very nervously, is the war close? And I knew I couldn't answer telling her yes, because that would deeply upset her. I couldn't lie to her and say no, because she can hear and see everything. So I brought her to the mattress. We lied down, and I told her what we hear is the Ukrainian military shooting down the drones. And she relaxed instantly. So the experience is in large part based on kind of those words, and I built the voiceover around that. So the beginning starts off with something along those lines, and then the end where you see the room destroyed, that's basically based on my worst fears. Thankfully, that has not happened to us, but it's happened quite close.
To many families.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So when I was in the experience, the first few moments, it's almost like a proscenium, because the initial POV is you're sitting at a desk and there's a computer and I assume your coffee cup and the view from your apartment window. As I looked around, I could see a bed behind me, bookshelves, you know, paraphernalia of family life, exercise mats, kids' art on the walls. And then as soon as the text messages start coming, they flash up pretty prominently in my point of view. And then, you know, the missiles and the drone fire starts happening. It went so far beyond what just any proscenium theatrical experience could ever do. Did you feel like you wanted to make some choices about how far you wanted to take this, how close you wanted to put your audience into the experience?
I want them to feel it to an extent. When I view it, I feel like they might just get a flavor or a small taste. And that, to me, I think is enough. It's really difficult to get people to pay attention to just about anything these days. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine is well into its fifth year already. So for me, this is a way to try to get audiences to concentrate beyond scrolling past photographs or videos on TikTok. They have to sit here and kind of experience this for a full 10 minutes.
I've thought about that many times over the past few years. In the early weeks and even months of the war, it felt like it was all anybody was talking about. And then a lot of other stuff started happening. You know, there were other flashpoints around the world. October 7th in Israel and the, you know, the Palestinian and Israeli voices that we did need to hear were also important at that time. I wonder, though, that challenge of breaking through, what Ukrainian people have felt as the rest of the world has had to go ahead with its business in the face of devastation.
I think Ukrainians just work hard to try to focus and notice us when we can. I think that's a large part of it. We have no other choice, really. Europe, I think, is most of Europe tends to look at Ukraine a little bit more closely, I think, because they're physically closer to this war than a lot of the world, the rest of the world. But it's tough, I'll be honest with you. It's difficult on every level. So I view this as a way to just try to get the information out there.
My guest today is Joseph Sywenke, who's a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Michigan. We're talking about the VR documentary experience he created called Is the War Close? I don't know if anyone's ever seen the gear that's used to create a VR experience, but it's kind of elaborate. You said you started thinking about VR in 2017, mm-hmm. So this was not your first time working with the technology?
No, it wasn't. Then, at that time, if you wanted to do 6 Degree of Freedom VR experience, you needed to have a headset connected to a computer, a powerful computer. You needed to have sensors on stands surrounding you in four corners. And so there was a limit of just size, weight, accessibility with needing this camera or needing with this high-priced headset with a high-priced computer. Now you can build them into a headset that might cost $400. So it's a lot more accessible. And my goal for the project is to show it at festivals, have it in galleries, have friends and journalists and activists who are traveling. They can actually just carry this with them and show it when they're abroad. This is definitely made for an international audience. Ukrainians know this, experience it every day. There's no reason for this to be showing in Ukraine. This is for an international audience.
What were the ways that your experience as a photojournalist came into play as you were designing this? There are a few static images mm-hmm. that come up through the course of the narrative, but was it possible for you to use your photographic eye?
It's a very different way of working because you're working in three dimensions. So a lot of it actually does come down to a sense of composition. You start looking out this window. That's, to me, is a very kind of simple photographic way POV, of looking at the world. Yeah. Like it's POV. And the last scene where you're in the destroyed house, it's the same thing. That's a very typical kind of photograph that I would take in a scene like that, showing the devastation in the foreground and then the other damaged buildings in the background, you know, further away. But here you've got to see both.
What was it like working with the designers and developers who built this?
Oh, they're amazing, dedicated. They're basically faculty members, students, and professors at the university. So it's a very small team of, game developers, audio engineers, and sound mixers. All of the audio in the experience was actually recorded by a colleague in Ukraine who's he works basically in cinema. And he puts a shotgun mic every night pointing at his window before he goes to sleep and just records what happens and looks at the wavelengths and sees if there was something going boom, he saves it. So when I contacted him about this project, he just sent me files and files and files, and I just went through. And these attacks happen so frequently in Ukraine that literally I would hear him snoring. If there was a large blast, he would kind of wake up slightly and then just go back to sleep.
It's a very evocative sound.
Yeah. Yes. And so then we took multiple attacks, mixed it, and turned it into kind of one. And then a wonderful sound engineer at the university named Eloise, she took that and spatialized it. So it's spatial audio. Things feel and sound like they're flying through the air over you.
One of the things that came up for me as I was going through this was just the question of that I think it's kind of hard to see truly unless you're in a combat situation. The question in your mind of where is the next one coming from? Is it coming at me? And I just wonder, would you be open to sharing a little bit of what that experience has been like for you personally?
There's essentially kind of two versions of this. There's the version where you're close or along the front line, and that's one thing. And then there's the version where you're far away from the front line and you're at home and the front line essentially comes to you and you know it can come to you pretty much at any moment.
As the girl in this, whose voice we hear is saying.
Yeah. Most of the time, there'll be an air raid alert beforehand. On very rare occasions, something will go boom beforehand. That sometimes the things can sneak through. It's rare, but it happens. Most often, you'll have plenty of time to take shelter. Sometimes it can literally be seconds. So it's quite different when you're close to the front line. You have to worry about different things, different styles of drones and artillery and things of that nature. It's a totally different world. And I should also just add the front line in Ukraine is something around 750 miles long. Most of it is fairly active. Certain sections are unbelievably, like there's 24/7 thousands of drones in the air. So it's, I don't know. It's just something that unfortunately you just have to get used to and deal with.
What do you think this technology offers us in our understanding of where war happens? Past points in history, there was a battlefield. Mm-hmm. And at many points throughout human history, also the war has come to people's homes. Mm-hmm. I guess I feel like that's something that's happened a little bit more often in modern history. The war is not limited to strike zones or militarily significant targets. Mm-hmm. Bombings are just happening in cities where people live.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just seems to me to bring many of these issues home in ways that even photos don't do quite as evocatively. You know, the pictures of children's art on the walls, the books on the night table next to the bed.
Yeah. No, I wanted people to feel like this is a place that they could be. This feels comfortable and normal to them. You know, in Ukraine, I live a normal middle-class life, and I think that's how most people can probably relate to it, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, international media tends to concentrate specifically on certain things. People start to develop kind of a visual idea of what that place looks like, and here I wanted to remind them of, like, normalcy.
It's a home.
Yeah, it's a home, exactly.
You've been emphatic that this is a work of documentary. Why is it important to you that it be classified in that way?
That's a good question.
I mean, this is not a reenactment of a specific air raid, is it?
No. I thought at one point of possibly trying to do that, and it's possible, I think, to do that, of one attack, but it's a much larger project with a much larger team and much larger budget. I think that is possible to do. But here, what I wanted to do is concentrate on trying to tell a story. I call it a documentary because everything that happens in here is based on things that have happened. Some of it directly to me, some thankfully not, at least not yet. But it's all based on actual events.
It's interesting to think about what it might be like to have an experience like this that spanned an entire night, where periodically your sleep is disrupted by bombs.
When I started this project, I remember thinking when we started spatializing and condensing one kind of an attack that took maybe, let's say, several hours. So 2 years ago, an attack might last 3 hours on Kyiv, for example. Now they're lasting 7 to 8. So when I was back home in Ukraine this past summer, the attacks were so much harder with so much more flying in the air that this actually sounded completely realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in terms of the frequency and the sounds. 2 years ago, it was considered a large attack of 70 drones and a half a dozen missiles attacked Kyiv. Now it's 750 plus and dozens of missiles and drones, dozens of missiles and ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, quasi hypersonic missiles, all kind of coming in at the, you know, trying to overwhelm the air defenses and then come in at one time and just start smacking targets. And this happens all the time. Just a few days ago, actually, a new anti-record, as we say in Ukraine, was broken. I think there was 945 drones fired at Ukraine in a span of 24 hours. So it's pretty harsh. Yeah.
Joseph Sywenki is a Ukrainian-American journalist who spent decades living in, working in, and covering what's happening in Ukraine. He's a visiting professor at the U of M this year, and his VR experience, Is the War Close?, will be screened as part of the Ann Arbor Film Festival this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at noon. If you want to go, this is happening at the Michigan Theater.
I'll just add Michigan Theater from 11 to 3 on Saturday.
11 to 3, thank you.
And then Sunday, 12 to 4.
Obviously, this is a process, getting people cycled through. You're not sitting and staring at a screen.
Yep.
Joseph, thank you very much for your work and for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor. Thank you.
That's all for Stateside for today. We have some fantastic special programming around National Poetry Month coming up next week. We hope you enjoy it.
Stateside's producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our show's senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Molly Anderson, Astrid Code, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside is a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you next time. Take care.